Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in a rare and surprising court victory, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke was found guilty of the murder of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. This is only the first time in 50 years a Chicago officer has been found guilty of killing in the line of duty. We'll also talk about a violent military occupation in the African territory of Ambazonia. In this colony, peaceful protesters are met with violent killings, their villages burned, often with people in them, and forcible flight to other countries. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. 4 years ago, Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke shot 17-year-old Laquan McDonald 16 times in the back. On October 5th, he was found guilty of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery by a Chicago jury. This was the first time in 50 years that a Chicago police officer has been found guilty of murdering somebody while on duty. Nationally, there have been no convictions in the murders of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, or Trayvon Martin. The McDonald murder was covered up, beginning with police who were on the job with Van Dyke, to commanding officers of the Chicago Police Department, and all the way up to the office of Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Key to this conviction was video footage taken by a police car dash camera. The video was suppressed by the police and the mayor for 3 years, and it was only revealed after a massive campaign by several Chicago grassroots organizations. From 2011 to 2016, $371 million has been spent by the government of Chicago on police misconduct cases. 40% of the city's budget goes to the police department. Here to talk with us about the situation in Chicago is returning guest attorney Flint Taylor. Taylor is a partner in the renowned Chicago law firm, the People's Law Office. He has been litigating police abuse cases for nearly 50 years, starting with his victory in the Fred Hampton case, where the FBI and the Chicago Police Department admitted they assassinated Black Panther Party leader Fred Hampton. Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be back, Heidi.
Well, the Jason Van Dyke verdict was really a big deal, wasn't it?
It was and is and will be here in Chicago and nationally.
Can you tell us about the cover-up, starting with the police officers who accompanied Van Dyke? How high up did this go?
Well, the cover-up or the code of silence, it wasn't unusual when you look at it or analyze it. What was unusual was that there was a videotape that showed what actually happened, and we all have seen it, or most people have seen it by now, that the wanton killing of Laquan McDonald was right there for all to see once the video came out. But before it came out, the police officers, the partner and the others involved went about their code of silence business in justifying the shooting by making Laquan the aggressor and all of that kind of standard lie. What happened, however, was that the videotape exposed that lie when it came out. And the videotape didn't come out for some time, so that cover-up went on not only at the level of the street, but also in terms of the supervisors, all the way up the chain of command in the police department. and the Corporation Council, the lawyer's office, and we think the mayor himself knew of the video as well, and they moved to settle the civil case that really hadn't even been filed yet with the family because they knew that the videotape would come out. And this was, of course, in the run-up to the 2015 mayoral election in which Rahm Emanuel was facing a serious challenge from progressive candidate Chuy García. So that video, the settlement happened right before the mayoral runoff, and also it happened the same day that reparations were approved for the survivors of police torture. So it really was a political storm in a sense, because Rahm had curried favor in the African American community by the agreeing to the reparations, but on the other hand was sitting, or his people were sitting, on this explosive video.
Now, let's talk about standard procedure in terms of releasing video. I've always been curious when I see police video shown on TV, for example, in the case of excessive use of force. They're on the body cam. And then what happens to the actual video? Is there a possibility that the police could alter it in any way?
Well, it's interesting that before, here in Chicago, before Laquan McDonald case, there was no standard procedure, and now they have to post all videos on the police accountability investigative website at the earliest possible time. There are various ways that videos can be, if not altered, not taken. I think what you see very often, and particularly in the earlier stages of body cams, they would not be working. The batteries would be put in backwards. The batteries would not be in the cameras, that kind of thing. We had a police shooting case, a very sad case where the police shot and killed a mentally disturbed woman on the north side of Chicago. And there was a police camera, you know, a security camera right above the bench where she was shot, but that wasn't working that night. That is the more frequent thing you see, that the body cam wasn't working. And also with regard to the release, the various places and municipalities have different procedures or regulations, or the lack thereof, in terms of the release of the video.
And does the officer have to actually turn on the cam, or is it automatically on?
I think that also depends. I know in Milwaukee we have a case where a man died in the back of a police car. And it's a well-known case up there called Derek Williams was the young man who died. It's a terrible video, and he's squirming around. He can't breathe, and he's saying he can't breathe. And the cops, the detectives and cops are saying, you're faking it. You just want to go to the hospital rather than to jail. And so for minutes, literally 8 minutes, he is on video writhing as he dies. That video, the computer that the police who were sitting in the front seat of the auto that in which the man was in the back, had a button. If you push the button, you could see what was going on in the back. If you didn't push the button, the computer would be doing regular police business. And these officers claimed they didn't even bother to push the button to see the man writhing in the back of the police car for some 6 or 8 minutes. It's a horrendous case. But in that instance, the video went on when they put him in the car. but the audio did not go on for 30 seconds after. And so there's various technicalities in terms of when the video goes on, when the audio goes on, how it's controlled or not controlled, how it's stored, how it's released. It's a very, in the two circumstances I've been involved in here in Chicago and in Milwaukee, there are various technicalities or procedures that apply.
In this particular case and the verdict, it's the first time in 50 years that a Chicago police officer has been found guilty of murdering someone while on duty. Were you afraid it might not result in a guilty verdict?
I had just finished an article for Truthout looking at the history of police violence in Chicago through the lens of two of the most important cases, that being the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the Black Panther leaders in 1969, and also the John Birch torture scandal, of police torture that went on for 20 years here. In the Birch case, he was ultimately indicted for obstruction of justice and perjury in 2008 and tried in 2010 before a almost exclusively white jury. As in the Burge case, in the Van Dyke case, we were, of course, nervous and worried that a predominantly white jury would be swayed by the racist defense that was put on by Fraternal Order of Police lawyers. But the juries in both instances were able to put aside those pleas to the base instincts and to be swayed by the enormity of the crime that was being presented to them, and convicted in the case of Burge in 2010, him for perjury and obstruction of justice, and here for, of course, second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery.
Flint, our co-host Michael Smith can't be with us today, but he wanted to ask you, do you think the evidence showed that Van Dyke was guilty of first-degree murder?
Well, that's an interesting question. You would probably get different answers from different lawyers and people from the community. I think it's important to note that, by and large, the activists that fought so hard for this trial and for a verdict of guilty, and people in the African community, African-American community, by and large, were not only satisfied by the verdict, but felt that in the fact that he not only was found guilty of second-degree murder and of all the counts for each bullet that he fired was a modicum of justice. You could say, looking at the case and comparing it to a regular murder case where the defendant was not a police officer, that a regular citizen would probably have been convicted of first-degree murder without much question. But we, because there's such a higher standard, both politically, socially, and legally, for a police officer who commits the same kind of misconduct or violence that an individual citizen might commit, that second-degree murder, given the defense that leads to it, and that is it was unreasonable for him to have shot Laquan McDonald 16 times, but he had a reasonable belief. It was an unreasonable belief, but he believed it. That led to second degree rather than to first degree.
Michael Smith also found a quote from James Baldwin, who wrote that, quote, "The police are simply the hired enemies of black people. They are present to keep us in our place and to protect white business interests. And they have no other function. And since they know they are hated, they are always afraid. One cannot possibly arrive at a more surefire formula for cruelty." Now, Black Lives Matter has proposed community control over the police department. Is that even viable, and what might that look like?
Well, I have to commend Michael Smith. He's always goes right to the heart of issues, and that certainly is a wonderful quote that he has put forward here. And I think it's an accurate quote in terms of the realities some 50 years after James Baldwin wrote it. Black Lives Matter doesn't simply seek they do seek community control over police, they really are ultimately calling for the abolishment of police, like the movement that calls for the abolishment of prisons. And you can see here in Chicago some of the approaches that they're taking, the movement for Black Lives is taking here, in the battle that they're leading against the police academy. The mayor, the outgoing now Mayor Emanuel, wants to have a $95 million police academy. Now, some reformers would say, that's a good idea because what we need here is better training for the police. Now, of course, Baldwin would disagree with that. I think that a lot of people that have been involved in the fight for for justice with regard to police violence would be very skeptical that that would be a meaningful reform. And so what the Movement for Black Lives has done is oppose the Cop Academy and opposed it by saying that $95 million should go to the heart of the problems that we have here. That is such things as closing mental health clinics, poverty, education, that those are the kinds of issues that really underlie the problems in the African American and other communities of color and poor communities. So that is a way forward towards ultimate abolishment of police as we know it, which is what the Movement for Black Lives is seeking here and I believe across the country.
Just a few hours before we recorded this segment, Reuters reported that U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said that the Justice Department will oppose a proposed consent decree to reform the Chicago Police Department in response to misconduct allegations after the slaying of a black teen by a white officer. Now, Trump is saying that a consent decree will result in a crime spree, and I think specifically that's because of fear that loosening restrictions on stop and frisk practices will unleash crime. Your thoughts on that?
Well, we of course it's Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III that we're dealing with here, and it's just another of the more outrageous manifestations of this administration's approach to policing. And it's quite stark in this particular circumstance where Obama's Justice Department did a very thorough 13-month investigation and wrote a long report that called for reforms in the police department to deal specifically with excessive force in what they termed a racist police department. And so right after one of the most extreme cases of police violence is tried, Sessions has the audacity, but of course the power, to again assert the diametrically opposed position that the Obama administration took, and that is that this consent decree is not necessary, and they will go into court where it's now being heard, and they're trying to determine the details of this decree and oppose it. The same government who, in fact, under the Obama administration, fashioned the remedies is now opposing those remedies that the city of Chicago and the attorney general of the state of Illinois are saying should be imposed. So we see once again that I guess you would say that this is the other side of the coin that James Baldwin was pointing out. This is just the raw racist approach by government rather than the kind of what some people might call the cosmetic attempts to reform the police department. But I think people who fight against police violence Many of them feel that you do need to resist police violence by seeking such things as consent decrees, so that you can at least have some method of enforcement when the police act in the manner that we so often see them act.
And a measure of accountability as well.
Exactly.
We just have a few minutes remaining, Flynn. I want to ask, what's happened to the political careers of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, the state's attorney, and the Chicago chief of police?
Well, when the video came out, and the video came out because a reporter and lawyers went to court under the Freedom of Information Act, they had wind of the fact there was a video, and a judge just before Thanksgiving ordered that it be released. So a few days before that, the then state's attorney of Cook County, who was a machine Democrat, who had followed in the line of the Daily Machine and the Divine Machine, part of the Daily Machine, moved to indict Van Dyke ahead of the video coming out. Well, of course, the city went was completely and the movement was completely shocked by the video. There were demonstrations all over the city, and particularly on the Magnificent Mile in the Gold Coast area of Chicago around Thanksgiving, and that led to not only the government's investigation, but a local investigation by a mayor's task force. The police chief, Jerry McCarthy, was forced to resign. He's now running for mayor. Alvarez, the state's attorney, because she had the video and had done nothing until it came out, at least publicly, was voted out of office that spring by forces, the same kind of forces that came together to vote the state's attorney out after the Fred Hampton assassination, and the same movement that came together to vote in Harold Washington. These were like extensions of the same movement, the next generation of that movement. But after Alvarez was voted out and Kim Fox, a progressive African-American lawyer, was voted in as state's attorney, Rahm Emanuel just recently, just before the Van Dyke case went to trial, announced that he was not going to run for re-election because he has been saddled with the knowledge of the videotape and a political motives to keep it under wraps until after the election of 2015. So we now see three of the major actors and those who both symbolically and in actuality were involved in the cover-up, having in one form or another either stepped down or being forced out of office.
Well, this is quite a story. We are just hugely grateful for this verdict. And I want to let you know, Flint, that Michael and I have the utmost respect for all the work that you're doing at the People's Law Office over these past few decades. How can people learn more about your work?
Well, they can go to our website, which is we're reconstructing to try to get into the next decade of the 21st century, but we do have a lot of very interesting information that we try to keep updated about the cases we're working on, about the historical context of those cases, some of which I've mentioned, the Fred Hampton Black Panther case, also the Birch torture cases, and many other wrongful conviction cases and police violence cases. Also, I do a lot of writing. I had mentioned that I have an article about the Van Dyke verdict that should be posted on Truth Out this past Wednesday. Also, I'm coming out with a book that's going to talk about some of these cases. Published by Haymarket and be coming out in February.
Congratulations. We look forward to that.
Thank you.
We'll post a link to your article on our website. And when your book comes out, we look forward to talking to you about it.
that will be great, and my best to Michael and his wife Debbie, who I know is recuperating at this point.
Yes, we'll convey that. And Flint, give our best to everyone in the office.
Yes, I certainly will, and it's great talking with you, Heidi.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Amazonia is an English-speaking territory located between Cameroon and Nigeria in West Africa. Also known as the Southern Cameroons, for most of its recent history, it has been under military occupation by the French neo-colonial regime in Cameroon. A majority of Amazonians reject the legitimacy of this regime and its military control. In violation of an agreement to create an equal confederacy between the two autonomous states, French Cameroon has been dismantling and defunding Ambazonian systems and pillaging its resources since the country was created in 1961. Since December 2016, French Cameroon military has responded to peaceful protests with force, killing over 400 civilians. 200 more have been disappeared and are feared dead. Over 90 villages have been burnt down, resulting in 60,000 people fleeing to neighboring Nigeria. Over 2,500 activists and peaceful protesters have been imprisoned, some tried in military courts, which is a violation of international law, and some sentenced for terrorism and other unjustifiable charges. Prisoners include prominent nonviolence advocate Julius Ayuk Tabe and 11 of his senior aides. They were arrested in January 2018 and unlawfully repatriated. Julius's appeal hearing just happened last Thursday. On January 26, 2018, with no extradition treaty between Cameroon and Nigeria, and without a presiding judge present, Nigeria forcibly handed 10 of the prisoners and 37 other refugees to Cameroon. This action drew condemnation from Amnesty International, the U.S. Department of State, and several other leading human rights advocates. The Ambazonia Prisoners of Conscience Support Network, or APOCS, was recently formed to address this crisis. Here to talk with us is Sphinx Eben, a founding member of APOCS and a longtime media organizer with the Indie Media Africa Working Group. Sphinx, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Heidi, for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Before we start talking about Ambazonia, can you give a brief background of how you became involved in this work?
Thanks again. I was born in Ambazonia, that is in West Africa, between Cameroon and Nigeria. That's a geographical location. I was high school, what would be called college there, but here would be kind of after high school, student activist. And so I was forced into exile in 1996 because of my involvement in the pro-democracy movement that was starting at the time in 1996 in Ambazonia, and I've been in exile since then. When I got in exile, I got introduced to the media democracy movement and open source and media democracy movement, the independent media networks. That was just the start of it. In fact, it started in 1999 in the Battle of Seattle, as people regularly call it these days. I joined the movement, and I that was where most of my organizing focus for the next, you know, up to now, basically, even though I've done other things on the site. But that also kind of gave me a deep appreciation of not just the power of media, but also the, more importantly, the power of open source technology and the need for society to not just control, but more importantly, to be able to access all the goodies that we can get out of software. So the famous line is that if the person who invented the piano had copyrighted every sound out of the piano, we probably would have been deprived of a lot of good music that we get today.
Well put. The U.S. media has not been covering much of what's happening right now in Ambazonia. Can you provide sort of an introductory overview?
Yeah, so Ambazonia, which used to be called the United Nations Trust Territory of Southern Cameroon under British administration, is a territory that has gone through this endless cycle of colonialism. In part, it's tied to the resources, natural resources, but also in part it's tied to the topography, right? So it was initially first colonized by the British, Afrisaker, in the early part of the African colonization, scramble for Africa. And then the British then handed it over. It was difficult. The British had intended to make it be part of their colony of Nigeria. But because of the rugged terrain between Ambazonia and Nigeria, administering it together was just a headache. So they gave it over to the Germans as part of the negotiations at the Berlin Conference, which my comrades like to refer to as a version of the World Trade Organization conference that happened in that time. And so then that's how it ended up becoming first British, then ended up becoming German, part of the German colony of Cameroon. And then when the Germans lost the First World War, it was it was seized from the Germans and divided between Cameroon and between the French and the British. So that's how it came back under British control as quote-unquote United Nations Trust Territory, this time not just as a colonial territory, for the British to prepare it for independence. Because what had happened then in the 60s is that the UN had passed the resolution that declared colonialism a crime against humanity, and so you couldn't own colonies officially anymore. And so all the former German colonies became quote-unquote UN trust territories to be prepared for independence. And that's how local colonial officials from the British government tried. I think the people on the ground really believed in this concept of a post-colonial world. But the bigger political game wouldn't allow that. So you have, for example, British colonialism was not fun for our people. Our people do not remember it as the best thing that ever happened to them. But compared to French colonialism, it was definitely the better option, right? You have a situation where they helped build, you know, trade unions. They helped build an educational system that was based on active participation of parents, teachers, associations, and teachers and students. They helped build quote-unquote common law-based human civil liberties-based legal system, public cooperatives to help the farmers be able to sell their products more efficiently out of the country and be able to... So the officials on the ground did quite an impressive job. The problem was the bigger political game at play, right? And the British, at the time, oil was just starting to become the bloodstream of global markets. But before that, it was always tropical crops. And so the British were not about to just let go of all the tropical crops they were getting from Ambazonia. And so what they did in that process, instead of allowing going through the process that the UN had recommended to prepare the country for independence, instead they decided they needed to figure out some way to short-circuit this independence that can guarantee that continuous British exploitation of the resources that are on the ground. And one of their initial proposals to the Ambazonian political leadership at the time was that, well, how about you just join Nigeria, right? Because they were already controlling Nigeria. And the Ambazonians were like, we think we deserve to be independent. And so in the very last minute of the conversation, the British at the UN insisted that these people cannot get independence. So they would have to get independence by joining either Nigeria or Cameroon. And that's how we ended up in this quagmire that is had such devastating consequences to our community, especially when one factors the fact that Cameroon itself, in their own struggle to try and get independence from France, it didn't quite pan out well. And that is what brings in that topic that I mentioned before of Francafrique.
And I wanted to ask you, can you describe Francafrique?
Yeah, so Francafrique is a very peculiar type of French neocolonialism, which is difficult for people who have not lived through it to appreciate it. But if you were, when the American civil rights leader Bill Sutherland, in his book Guns and Gandhi, when he was doing interviews for the book, he was interviewing Kenneth Kaunda, who is a renowned civil rights movement leader in Africa, who was first president of Zambia. He came here, he worked with Martin Luther King for a long time, very famous international non-Gandhian activist. And I remember Bill Sutherland, the African-American leader, civil rights leader, said to him, hey, we've passed a whole half century trying to help Africa. What's the problem? Why is one crisis after another in Africa? And Kaunda did not drop, you know, a word. He immediately said the devil in Africa is France. Right now, for people who do not, you know, people from especially English-speaking communities, people who are not French, people who do not live through that, it doesn't compute. But for people who live through Francafrique, it becomes apparent what he's talking about. So this is a kind of situation where the United Nations passed the law making colonization illegal, crime against humanity, and the French decided that okay, officially we cannot keep these colonies, but what we're going to do is, we're going to eliminate the local indigenous leaders and then transform the colonial administration into the quote-unquote new independent leadership of the countries. And so that would be, an example would be the Brenner. It's simple, just a little bit comparison, but not complete, would be the Brenner administration of Iraq, where the entire leadership is, the policies are framed in the United States, but, you know, quote-unquote, it was an Iraqi government. And but the problem with the Francafrique version is that it's accompanied by extreme violence. Mm. That's why if you look at all African independent leaders of the 50s and 60s, the majority of the ones that were assassinated were in those Francafrique countries. So you have Togo. Olympia was assassinated by the French. You have Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso was assassinated by the French. You have Omiyobe Robin and Félix Moubier in Cameroon were assassinated by the French. If you just go through the list, what will stand out for you is that most of the independent leaders in Africa who were assassinated either on the eve of independence of their country were mostly from these specific Francafrique countries. And that is how we ended up with a situation where you have about 14 African countries who do not have a central bank. The economy is run essentially from Paris because the French still run the economy. The French print their money, decide monetary policy. I mean, that is what colonialism was all about, except that this time the French say, oh, no, it's a cooperation agreement that made us, you know, give us the right to run the economies of these countries and to still administer the economy, determine monetary policy. And it's a shame that the European Union, when France stopped existing, when France became part of the European Union, the European Union Central Bank decided to take responsibility for that operation.
Now, I understand that since December 2016, mm-hmm. the French Cameroon military has really been heavy-handed in terms of the violence to peaceful protesters. I understand villages have been burned down and tens of thousands of individuals have fled to Nigeria. What happened to trigger that?
Yeah, so what has happened is that since the 1960s, when this ill-fated joining with Cameroon happened, there have been a resistance in Ambazonia since then to the loss of their ability to be an independent people, independent community, you know. And then there's the problem of the French neocolonial domination that has kind of just eviscerated the economy, eviscerated public indigenous institutions. And so that resistance has always been nonviolent. It's been led by, in fact, the slogan is the force of argument, not the argument of force, right?
And nice.
Yeah, and so that movement has always been there. And, of course, people have always been killed every now and then. But there was no way to illustrate it in as stark a situation as it was in 2016. Right, 2016, the social media is now present. We are no more living in the world where there was only people could only hear on radio, or where you could hear that, you know, you could hear that women and children have been shot. That is not as viscerally moving as watching footage of helicopter gunships firing live ammunition on protesters who were peaceful and the only thing they had were leaves to show their symbol of peace. And so in 2016, the very peculiar thing is that for all these years, the Cameroon government had gutted public institutions. They disbanded the parliament, they disbanded the Confederation of Teachers. They've done everything, but the one thing they have not succeeded to do this far was disband the civil liberties-based common law system in Ambazonia. And that is what became the last tool of fighting, right? The government tries to seize land here, people sue them. The government tries to seize water that the community already built, the infrastructure for water. The government said, we're going to start taxing this water. The community sued them, so the government decided finally, okay, we've had enough of this. We're going to remove the legal system and replace it with the French colonial legal system, which basically says the government makes law as opposed to the common law system. And so that was the thing that happened in 2016 when the government decided we're going to scrape your legal system and replace it with the quote-unquote French-based legal system. And the public was like, okay, we have had it.
Right.
We will not let this happen. This is, we know what is going to happen. This will be the last ground of that resistance. And that is how this fight, this wave of resistance had a very peculiar character. So the lawyers called for a general strike, which in Ambazonia they call it ghost town. And of course the teachers who have been at the receiving end of the regime's exploits. And the students, the student union, teachers union, automatically joined because the part of the society that started getting the immediate impact of the disenfranchisement of the community was always students, right? The government wanted to create out of them a bunch of laborers, manual laborers, as opposed to students. And so they have always been at the receiving end. There have always been protests, mostly students-led. This whole movement is mostly student-led. But this time, the lawyers took the leadership because the lawyers were like, they're going to deprive us of common law. It's over. And the students were like, we have always been at the receiving end. Society, let's do this. And there was this general shutdown of the territory. No movement, general strike, businesses closed. Everything was shut down. It was until on October 1st, which is kind of the day that the UN had designated Ambazonian independence, people came out with peaceful branches to celebrate that day. The government sent a helicopter gunship. And something like about 100 people were shot dead. And for the first time, these are the distinct characters of that particular incident. For the first time in the history of this struggle that has been going on for half a century, for the first time some communities decided, okay, we're going to defend our communities with force.
Repeat that, though. The UN declared Ambazonia.
The UN had in 1961.
Exactly.
It was October 1
yep.
was the day that officially Ambazonia was supposed to pay. UN 1961
yes.
resolution to have gotten independence. Cameroon had made it illegal to celebrate that day. But now, in the face of all what was happening in 2016, the public was like, we will celebrate that day now.
Nice.
And people came out. It was a massive protest across
right.
the whole country. It was clear the movement nonviolent. Everybody was with leaves. So leaves is for us in our community, a leaf, an olive branch is a symbol of peace, nonviolence. And the government responded to that with this slaughter. Right?
Slaughter.
Suddenly,
right.
people looked at the social media and they saw what they have been hearing, but for the first time they saw people being killed.
What's the population of Ambazonia?
So Ambazonia, that's another very interesting, thank you for that question, because in Cameroon, officially, census numbers are still state secret, right?
State secret?
Yes. This is, if you look at colonial history, that's a very important
oh,
tool in manipulating
right.
stuff, because if this government is the only one that has the exact numbers of the population, you can always manipulate policy the way you want. You can pretend that one sector is 10 times bigger, but officially, people still accept that Ambazonia is, population-wise compared to Cameroon, is 20% if you put the two together. Ambazonians question that because in 1961, when we joined them, we were one-third, right? 20% is one-fifth. So
right.
the question then becomes, what happened between 1961 and now that makes us go from one-third and you being two-third
yes.
to becoming one-fifth? So, but if you take it at one-fifth, that leaves one-fifth, as the government says, that leaves us at about 8 million people compared in a 25 million population in the area. So that's the outline of the situation.
There was a recent election in Cameroon. How will that impact the current situation?
That is very dramatic because that election emphasized two very important things. The first thing that it emphasized was that in in the tactic of nonviolent resistance, the Ambazonian public massively boycotted that election as a way to communicate the illegitimacy of the occupation that has been going on. And the government had decided that they were going to use maximum violence, and then they're going to, you know, make a sham illustration that the vote has happened. And they were hoping that maybe at least 5% of the population can show up, and then they can pretend that this is not 5%, this is maybe half the population. Unfortunately, less than 1% of the population, which is mostly public officials, that showed up for the election. So even the Cameroon government has finally accepted publicly that there was general non-participation. And for us, that's a statement of a non-resistant, non-violent tactic in resisting the occupation. And that's the political implication on the Ambazonian side. Now on the Cameroon side, a country that up until Ambazonians started protesting in the 90s, never had any elections since their independence, Cameroon never had any one because it's a new colonial republic. The French have continued to run it that way. But because of protests in the 90s by Ambazonians, we finally forced the whole Cameroon to accept multi-party. And from then, what the government instead decided to do was to kind of block real elections and make this sham of elections. That's why it's generally accepted that the Cameroon regime, the dictator in Cameroon, is the longest running dictatorship in the world. That's not questionable right now in terms of, you know, research or any analysts that are observing this from a neutral position. And that election has still not been decided because people casted their vote on the 7th, October 7th. The president who has been in power for 36 years, the dictator, Paul Biya, people were looking that he was going to basically do what he has done all this while. The United States refused to contribute any money for the election because the United States government said the government has refused to make the necessary electoral reforms to allow real elections to happen, and they were not going to waste U.S. taxpayers' money. The European Union refused to send observers because they thought it's just a scam and they had no reason to get caught up in the middle of trying to either legitimate the scam or openly embarrassing a regime that the French control. And so the European Union backed away from the election. And so you have a situation then that while everybody was expecting the dictator to declare himself a winner, unfortunately for him, part of the opposition had forestalled that, imagined that was going to happen. So once they were running apps on their phone, they designed a new app that was able to compile the electoral numbers as it was happening. And so within 48 hours of the elections, the computer had compiled all the reports that they could get from the polling stations that said the opposition had won. And the government did not have enough time to change the numbers. They have said election report will come out in 2 weeks and we don't want anybody to talk about elections until in 2 weeks' time. Everybody knew they wanted time so they could manipulate the numbers. The opposition leader shows his numbers and declares himself a winner. So there's a standoff right now between the regime in place and this opposition leader. That is in the Cameroon part of it. While in Ambazonia, our public, as part of our nonviolent resistance to the occupation, our people refuse to participate in the electoral scam. So that's where we are at with this election standoff right now.
Let's turn our attention now to Julius Ayuk Tabe, a peaceful activist who's been arrested with several others. What is the status of that case?
Yes, so Julius was arrested. They call him the Martin Luther King of Ambazonia because that has been his tactic, nonviolent, peaceful. He says we have all the legal evidence in our side. There's no point for us to give an excuse for them to, you know, paint us bad.
Right.
And so he and other community leaders were in a meeting in Nigeria to try to discuss about the case of our refugees with the UNHCR, and they got arrested on the probing from, apparently from Cameroon government. They got arrested and sent to Cameroon in violation of non-refoulement, which is a law that says, you know, if you take in refugees, you cannot send them back to a country where they will be prosecuted. He was held for almost 150 days without any access to family or lawyer. But thanks to the campaign that we were running for them to at least get access to lawyers, the Cameroon government finally, after 150 days, finally decided to give them access to lawyers. What happened was the lawyers interviewed them and finally got the full first-hand details of what happened exactly from the arrest. So the lawyers filed in the court what is called a habeas corpus writ, which says, hey, these people have been held illegally.
Give us the body,
thank you. And when that happened, they spooked the Cameroon government. They didn't expect, that's why they always wanted to hold them without any access to anything. When they filed that habeas corpus, the Cameroon government responded by imposing a bunch of government lawyers on his legal team, barring his lawyers from seeing them, and so that they were like, oh, if any lawyer is going to talk to the people in jail, it's going to be just the government lawyers that we imposed on the team. And then at the habeas corpus hearing, they didn't bring the body. I mean, every lawyer knows that a core piece of habeas corpus hearing is that the state brings the body and says, oh, well, it is the body. And then the court says, do you have any proof why you should keep this body? If the state doesn't have, then the court says, let the body go. The Cameroon government was like, nope, we cannot bring the body. We have to discuss this without the body, right? Which is a violation of the very concept of habeas corpus. And so the Cameroon government threw the case out, saying the government lawyers, which they said his they describe as his lawyers, have withdrawn the case. And so his official lawyers filed an appeal, and the appeal is going to be heard Thursday, which is...
Right. Yeah. It'll be heard a few days before this segment airs.
Exactly. And so that's the situation right now, this appeal on this violation of the fundamental premise of a habeas corpus hearing in terms of Julius. And we hear that they are not in the best shape. This is the most one of the most ruthless regimes in the world. They are not being held in some, you know, law-abiding prison state. The situation is really bad. But at least we are happy that we now know for sure that they are alive. Before, it wasn't clear for the 150
if
days.
If they were even alive.
Yes, thank you.
And I wonder if they've been tortured.
Oh, that definitely. We know that that has been tortured. That has happened. They were arrested. They didn't know who these people were in plain clothes. They were locked in a basement. We know that now for sure because their lawyers interviewed them before the habeas corpus. They were transported on a military plane from Nigeria to Cameroon without seatbelt in a plane. Since then, there have been all kinds of issues, you know. But again, we are just, as a community, we are happy that they are alive, for sure.
Tell me, Amnesty International, the U.S. Department of State, and several leading human rights advocates are aware and have condemned the forcible handing over of 10 prisoners and I think 37 other refugees to Cameroon. How involved is the international human rights faction in all of these things?
With reference to the international human rights community, it's been very mixed, right? The fact of the matter is that for more than the first 4 decades of our struggle, basically up to October 2016, the simple known international voice of our struggle. I mean, my comrades who were locked up in 1996 when I went to exile, I had student leaders, my colleagues, like Julius, like Ebenezer, who spent 7 years in jail for being student activists. The only voice that told the world about what was happening to us was Amnesty International. That's what they did. People had come to understand Amnesty as the champion that the world knows them for human rights. That is up till October 2017. We cannot really explain what happened. The branch of Amnesty West Africa, which covers our territory, suddenly changed their tone, right? They started calling our people separatists and all kinds of things. We don't know what's happening, but we can say for sure that Amnesty Nigeria has done an amazing job.
Okay.
Amnesty
Good.
Nigeria has
Good.
Stood by us. They condemned the arrest of Julius Ayuktabi, and Amnesty as a whole institution has been amazing in terms of every now and then. It's true that the reports are not the best, but they are at least the only thing we have. Now, we have had a far more dangerous situation with organizations like, for example, Crisis Group. Right? You have a situation where International Crisis Group, in that massacre on October 1st, which was reported by Amnesty for what it was, helicopter gunship on peaceful protest, that's how Amnesty reported it. For that massacre, International Crisis Group described it as there was some confrontation and 100 people are dead. But not only did they say that, they said it's time for the Cameroon president to take some real action to stop these extremist secessionist groups. Everybody was startled, like, well, what are you talking about? People just got killed, peaceful protesters. And our community was really furious at the smearing of the memory of these heroes of nonviolent resistance, right? Our community was just furious at International Crisis Group doing this to us.
And the problem is the mainstream media, especially in this country, is not covering the story.
That is a big problem for us. It's a big problem because then the public doesn't know. The public cannot engage with the topic. Public officials, elected officials cannot engage the topic well if the media is not engaging it because there's a general lack of knowledge, you know.
We unfortunately don't have too much more time, and we'd love to have you on again to start talking more regularly about this. But what can our listeners do to start being more aware of this situation? Is there a website?
Yes, thank you very much. We have the Ambazonia Prisoners of Conscience website. It is ambazoniapocs.net. That website has a lot of material on the situation. We are very, very active on Twitter.
Okay.
And
good.
The handle is APOCSNET, APOCSNET. That's the most active location where we have regular updates sometimes within the hour of developments on the ground. We have regular analysis. We have clarifications of what is happening within the movement, what is the posture of the movement in terms of moving international developments and so on.
Is there an exile community of Ambazonians in the United States?
Yes, there is an exile community of Ambazonians in the United States, and they have been doing what most exile communities do, call their congress people, visit their senators. But as we understand very well, most of the time you need to mobilize not just your own community, you need to mobilize your neighbors, your friends who are American citizens, for there to be real impact. And that aspect is the piece that the media is falling on, because once the media is able to handle that properly, it makes it easy to mobilize your neighbor to support. So we do have a community here. We've had, the community in Delaware is very powerful. The entire congressional delegation from Delaware issued a blistering statement condemning the Cameron government and calling upon them to act properly and to, respect human rights. And just a couple of days ago, we've had, Congressman Zetlin here in New York submit a bill at the time to condemn what Cameroon was doing. We have had Congresswoman Karen Bass try the same thing. We've had right now in the Senate, there's the bill on funding of U.S. diplomatic missions abroad. In the Senate, requested that the Secretary of State will have to update Congress on how Cameroon is improving on its human rights trial. Otherwise, they will not get any funding from the U.S. government. At this point, that's what we're hoping, that Americans can call the House, because the accompanying bill in the House does not have the same specific Cameroon-specific language, but the Senate bill has, and we're trying to hopefully push people to call their Congress people so that the congressional version of this Senate bill on funding has Cameroon-specific language. Right now, the accompanying House bill just has a generic language that says governments that need to be held accountable for human rights.
And your website has information about that on it.
Absolutely.
So we're going to encourage our listeners to go to the website and help stand up for Ambazonia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sphinx, for being on.
Thank you. Really appreciate you for having us.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later...
Moneyland is a concept. It's actually a very powerful one, trying to explain how the sort of transnational elite that are running so many countries is essentially broken free of any kind of democratic control.
We talk to journalist Oliver Buller about his book just out, Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. But first, here's a quick Tax Justice News Roundup for this month. Among other banking scandals, the boss of Denmark's biggest bank, Danske Bank, has resigned over 200 billion euros of what's called questionable money, which flowed through its Estonian branch over several years from non-resident customers. It was so dodgy looking that even the Russian Central Bank issued a warning through Danish regulators about the bank's activities. The Dutch bank ING has been fined $900 million for failing to prevent money laundering. Even the EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has called for greater anti-money laundering enforcement powers for the European Central Bank, along with lots of pressure from regulators across the European Union. In Andorra, charges have been brought by a judge against 9 people from Andorra, 5 from Spain, and 14 Venezuelans, including former ministers and public officials, in connection with the $2 billion plundering of a Venezuelan state-owned oil firm. None of the Venezuelans indicted in the case showed up to receive the court's notice. For most of them, their whereabouts are unknown. And just as so many Venezuelans are fleeing their country because of severe food and medicine shortages, a video has just gone viral showing their president, President Maduro, dining on steak and smoking a cigar at a high-class restaurant in Istanbul, Turkey. And finally, not all intimidation of journalists by the powerful wins through. The country of Azerbaijan sued French investigative journalists over a documentary where they called them a ferocious dictatorship back in 2015. But the Versailles Appeals Court has ruled that no nation state, ferocious dictatorship or otherwise, can sue for defamation. There's your quick news roundup. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, so this month is 10 years after the famous collapse of Lehman Brothers and the 2008 financial crash. Pretty much everybody does agree there's going to be another one pretty soon. But in 2008, really, there wasn't a very comprehensive alternative ideology in place to the sort of dominant narrative that we've heard ever since, that governments have maxed out their credit cards and the medicine now has to be austerity and a steady reduction in people's quality of life in order to fix things. And it hasn't fixed anything, has it?
In a word, no. That moment 10 years ago was a systemic failure of epic proportions. The bank directors failed in their duties, so did the auditors, so did the credit rating agencies, so did the regulators, so did the financial journalists. And it's worth refreshing our memory that so did the vast majority of neoliberal economists who were clueless about the risks and assumed, like Alan Greenspan of the Federal Reserve, that financial markets were self-correcting. And they were wrong. But there were some people, and I'd like to, in particular, to mention Susan Strange, who was flagging this up in the late 1990s, that all these credit default swaps and derivatives were hiding risks, and inevitably the whole thing was going to come very, very badly undone. So the idea that no one had seen it coming and that there were economists who didn't know about this is wrong. So the question is, what's happened in the intervening years? Now, first, the government stepped in to bail out the bankers, and the failed banks rebuilt their balance sheets, but they didn't change their ways. Quite the contrary. They went straight back to boosting real estate bubbles. They switched their activities, in some cases, to private equity businesses and shadow banks sitting offshore, largely to avoid taxes and avoid regulation. In some cases, they merged into even bigger banks, which makes the problem of the too-big-to-fail banks even worse now than 10 years ago. What they didn't do is invest in the real productive economy. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this failure to invest in the real economy. The latest figures for investment in the UK show that while 62% of all lending in 2017 went to financial intermediaries and to insurance, which, by the way, is largely banks lending to each other, and 15% of total lending went into real estate, only 4% went into manufacturing, and less than 4% went into the energy, water, transport, communications, and other vital infrastructure sectors of what's called the country's foundational economy. That is the economic base on which all wealth is created, and the prospects for future real recovery are very, very weak indeed. Now, the second big story coming out of the financial crisis 10 years ago was that despite all the banking frauds, the market rigging, the financial product mis-selling, the money laundering, the assisting with tax evasion, and so on, the cops weren't called in. Very few bankers have gone to jail, and a clear message has come out that top bankers are immune from prosecution. And in this respect, and I think this is really important to understand, public respect for the rule of law and democracy is fading fast. Now, on the banking regulation side, some minor changes have been implemented, but everyone knows that the level of household debt in the real economy is just totally unsustainable in most countries. And especially if interest rates are to rise in the near future, the risks of major systemic failure are as high now as they were in 2007, possibly even higher. But it gets worse. As the banking crisis spread into the real economy, neoliberal politicians reacted by imposing austerity measures just at the wrong time, which largely hit the poorest of the poor households and the poorest regions in countries and regions across Europe and the rest of the world, with the result that many economies have been in prolonged recession, poverty and inequality has worsened massively, and the crisis, as we all know, has spread into a full-blown political crisis. So if you join the dots between Lehman in 2008 and where we are 10 years later, you can see a full crisis of financial capitalism has led directly and is directly responsible for Brexit in Britain, for Donald Trump's election, and the rise of the radical right-wing governments and fascism in many parts of Europe and North America.
Okay, and on the one hand, we're seeing more of the same with wealth extraction rather than wealth creation, and the situation does look dark politically. But the flip side of that is that we have made quite a lot of progress, and a lot of that was kind of helped by the financial crisis from the point of view that there's been a lot of pressure coming from the people, from civil society, public anger towards politicians and big international organisations to actually do something. So we've had progress, not perfect, but important steps forward internationally, emerging global standards, things like country by country reporting for multinational companies, automatic information exchange agreements between countries, public registers of the real owners of companies. And there are some moves, we think, towards the idea of unitary taxation, which taxes companies based on the actual substance of their business more fairly. Not perfect, but that is what happens when the pressure comes from below, and we need to keep going with that.
There's definitely a better public understanding that financial crime and tax evasion are widespread, and they are caused by the failure in rulemaking. What are the next steps then for the tax justice movement? Because there's a real need to, this time, before the next crash comes, to have a really good, proper set of solutions very clearly fixed in people's minds, because the solutions are there.
Yeah, the solutions are there, and we need to anticipate that when the crash comes, and we all think it's going to come, possibly within the next 24 months, that politicians will need to hear from us, from civil society, this is what we're demanding. Now, I think that the tax justice movement globally needs to move forward in a number of directions. Here's my three top lines of attack.
Oh, good.
So, first, we need to shift tax regimes towards taxing wealth. We know that wealth inequality has become mad. We need to tax wealth rather than income. And in practical terms, that means land value taxes, cutting away all the exemptions around the capital gains tax regimes, removing all those vast numbers of tax reliefs available to industries like property development, for example, full-blown wealth taxes, and alongside that, a stronger corporate tax regime with significantly higher rates and virtually no tax reliefs made available to the big companies. Secondly, we have to address this, all the issues that are thrown up by this phenomenon called the finance curse. When a financial sector becomes too large, it moves from supporting wealth creation and it becomes a wealth extraction sector. It extracts wealth from the rest of the economy. Now, we can see this in many countries, perhaps most strikingly in the UK, where the City of London extracts huge sums from the rest of the economy. Now, tighter regulation and higher taxes, for example, a financial transaction tax, would reduce, if not eliminate, some of this economic blight. Next, I think we really have to address the whole role of the enablers. Not only have bankers and accountants and lawyers abandoned professional ethics in favour of profit maximisation, it should be clear to everyone by now that their business models are geared towards supporting tax avoidance, engaging in wealth extraction, assisting white-collar crime, and undermining democracy. So we have to focus on the professions. Ideally, we need to break up the big four accounting monopolies. which means in practice separating audit functions from all kinds of other consulting services, including tax services. And if necessary, we need to push for the creation of state auditors to strengthen multinational audits. Now, as far as the banks are concerned, much tougher treatment is needed to enforce cooperation on tackling tax evasion. And we must never again allow big global players of banks like HSBC, for example, to engage in money laundering without losing their license to operate. And 10 years after Lehman, the banking stables are as filthy as ever. The tax havens are still in business. Western liberal democracy is showing all the signs of cracking under the pressure. But I think it's civil society now that has to kind of fill that vacuum and come forward with the specific policy measures needed ahead of the next crisis and after the next crisis.
Yes, and we're going to talk about this next month in the TaxCast in edition 82 with Nick Shackson, whose new book, The Finance Curse, How Global Finance is Making Us All Poorer, and there's going to be a lot of ideas about that to come.
Yeah, now we need to win the arguments against the two big banks and the two big financial services sector and make the case that hosting a big financial services sector is not necessarily good for your national economy, let alone for the rest of the world.
And it's a national and international security threat as well. We'll talk about that next month.
We'll talk about that later.
Right, so another thing we talked about on the TaxCast is the rise of plutocracy, rule by the rich for the rich, government by the wealthy. And we've seen, you know, for example, as a manifestation of all this, two huge tax dodging companies hit $1 trillion in value this month, Apple and Amazon, or Scamazon, as I like to call them. And now, looking at the US government, which is full of extremely wealthy people who have been cutting away at all sorts of taxes, not for the little people, of course.
Sure.
Now, we've seen five of Trump's close advisors have been convicted of or admitted crimes. The former Trump campaign manager, Paul Manafort, has this month pleaded guilty to some lesser charges since he was facing a prospect of life in prison. He's sorted out a plea deal with prosecutors on charges relating to money laundering and undisclosed foreign lobbying, and all that means that he has to now sing like a canary, so that's going to be interesting. Now, he had deep ties to Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs, and apparently he built up a $65 million in foreign bank accounts just over a four-year period, which is really astonishing. Just by the by, he's a big fan of ostrich leather jackets. So an interesting development that tells us a lot about the Trump administration.
Yeah, and I think you're right to, you didn't use the word oligarchy to say that essentially the Trump government isn't a government of oligarchs. Finally, and this seems to have dragged on for endless months, Paul Manafort, who was campaign manager for Donald Trump, also a lawyer, is now a convict. Well, he was also a lawyer who abused the trial process. You might remember in June, he was sent to jail for attempting to tamper with the entire trial process by using encrypted telephone messaging to try to interfere with potential witnesses at his trial. So they sent him to jail. So this is a lawyer who is now being found guilty of the following crimes. First, guilty on five counts of tax fraud, guilty on two counts of banking fraud, guilty on one count of failing to disclose a foreign bank account, plus a further 10 counts of charges where the jury was unable to reach a consensus. 18 counts, I think, in total, 18 charges, quite extraordinary. So quite clearly, the president's former campaign manager was not a man who paid much attention to Abraham Lincoln's plea that US citizens should be of sound morality with a reverence for the Constitution and the law. Manafort, as you say, has connections throughout Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Russia. Much of his fortune appears to stem from those connections. And by and large, he seems to have been a mover and shaker. I mean, he's not actually doing business. He's selling influence. What emerges from Manafort's indictment and the subsequent trial is that this is a man who is intimately bound up in the world of offshore finance. In his indictment, Manafort, along with his business partner, a certain guy called Richard Gates, was accused of laundering $75 million US dollars through multiple bank accounts and shell companies set up in Cyprus, that's in the Mediterranean, Seychelles in the Indian Ocean, and St. Vincent and Grenadines, which is in the Caribbean. The real problem, I think, revealed by the Manafort trial is that he represents an entire class of what you might call offshore guys living in an offshore world. They think nothing of breaking laws and cheating societies. They have complete contempt for democracy. Now, whilst Manafort will spend the foreseeable future sitting in a prison cell thinking about his useless life, the problem is that far too many of the other perpetrators, in other words, that vast army of offshore lawyers, accountants and their clients, won't be joining him there in the prison.
Thanks, John. John Christensen from the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. TaxCast listeners know that rules and laws aren't meant for everyone to follow. They're just for the little people. This month on the TaxCast, I'm speaking to journalist and corruption sleuth Oliver Bullough, whose latest book is just out. And the title says it all, really. It's called Moneyland: Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. Let's start with what Moneyland actually means to you. Let's start there.
So Moneyland is an idea that came to me in Ukraine after the revolution in Ukraine, when there was this effort to track down the stolen assets of the former ruling elite. And the assets were gone, they'd vanished. And there were a lot of journalists like me sort of looking for them, trying to find out what kind of tricks they'd used, what sort of offshore structures they'd used. And it occurred to me that all of these assets that had been stolen weren't anywhere. They weren't in Britain, they weren't in Monaco, they weren't in Switzerland or Ukraine. They were somewhere else that didn't actually exist. And so the more I thought about it, the more helpful I found it as a concept, and the more sort of interesting a way of looking at the world, that essentially, if you're rich and your money is held in multiple jurisdictions and your life is in multiple jurisdictions, you're essentially able to pick and choose which laws you obey. You can say, well, you know, for taxation purposes, I'm going to obey the laws of Switzerland. For privacy purposes, I'm going to obey the laws of Nevis. For, you know, for education purposes, I think maybe the UK. For political lobbying purposes, the US. And it gets to the point when you no longer live in one country or have anything to do with one country. You've got a bespoke country of your own. And this is what I call Moneyland, trying to explain how the transnational elite that are running so many countries has essentially broken free of any kind of democratic control.
And we're increasingly seeing plutocracy rule by the rich for the rich, from Russia to the United States, with levels of greed you write about in the book that you just can't believe sometimes.
It's absolutely extraordinary, but that's just how the Moneyland system works. As long as one jurisdiction is prepared to rent out its structures and its legal system to wealthy people, then that's how the world works. Money is international. Money flows seamlessly around the world. Laws don't. And therefore, there will always be mismatches. And where there are mismatches, there are loopholes. And where there are loopholes, wealthy people and powerful people can take advantage. I spent quite a lot of time in St. Kitts and Nevis. Nevis is a particularly egregious tax haven that has been essentially created and crafted deliberately by American lawyers in order to allow their clients to dodge American law. And, you know, they have this approach whereby American lawyers write laws for them. They sort of groups of American lawyers, workshop the laws, pick and choose from all the different states of the union to create kind of super laws, which are kind of genetically engineered laws, which are so powerful that they combine the best aspects of Delaware and Wyoming and Nevada and South Dakota. And then they unleash them back on America. And they're extraordinary what you can do with them. And to be honest, Nevis is significantly better regulated. I mean, it's a swamp by any normal standards, but compared to Nevada, it's Sweden.
Right, and this market is not going anywhere anytime soon, right? Because, I mean, you're talking about the scale of the high net worth individuals and how that's projected to rise to $35.7 trillion. With an additional $8.7 trillion of newly created wealth over the next 5 years. And if that's true, then they'll have added the equivalent of the GDPs of Japan and Germany to their stock of wealth in half a decade. I mean, that's staggering. That's a huge amount of money washing around.
Yeah, I mean, it's massive. And what's interesting about this was this moneyed class, this sort of 1% that is dominating and 0.1% that is taking greater and greater proportion of the planet's wealth, is how this whole class of enablers is now being grown up to serve only their needs. And there's this very interesting sort of financial markets theory called plutonomy, which was created by a couple of very perceptive analysts from Citibank in the mid-2000s. And their idea was basically, now there are so many companies that serve only the needs of the 0.1%, that essentially they're entirely divorced from the rest of the economy. And it doesn't really matter what happens in the rest of the economy. So, say for someone like Burberry, you know, they'd just do fine whatever happens. You know, Patek Philippe, they don't need to worry about what the oil price is because people who buy them don't worry what the oil price is. And so essentially, if you invest your money in the shares of these companies, then you're going to gain a disproportionate return on the stock exchange and make more money, which you can then spend on these products, which you can then invest back. And it goes on and on in this sort of vicious circle. And it's totally changing how economies work. It does actually explain what's wrong with the world, why inequality is growing so much, you know, why politics in so many countries simultaneously, whether that's Turkey or Hungary or Poland or the United States or Britain, why politics is increasingly dominated by this very tight elite class. It's all about Moneyland.
Yes, and there is such disgusting examples of corruption in some places like Ukraine. And yet the enablers are in London, in Geneva, New York. And this is very useful for people like Putin to kind of use that against these countries by saying, oh, well, you know, they're no better than us.
We have a fundamentally wrong conception of what corruption is. Corruption has always existed. As long as there's been anyone with power, inevitably it will exist. But it was always confined to a place. Essentially, the corrupt person lived among his or her victims because you couldn't carry the money away with you. The money was, you know, physical wealth of some kind. The creation of the international financial system, and particularly the creation of the offshore financial system, which I get into in the book, basically divorced wealth from place. Wealth was suddenly in the cloud. It was anywhere and nowhere. And that takes off the limits of how much you can steal, because if you don't have to carry the money around with you, you can just keep stealing. And because of the connections offshore, you could then zip the money through the offshore system and it ends up in London where it couldn't be taken away from you. So I came up with this formulation: you steal it, you hide it, you spend it. And it's these three phases that are the heart of Moneyland, because previously you could steal stuff and spend it, but you could see the connection between them, or you could steal stuff and hide it. But if you hid it, then you couldn't do anything with it. It was the fact that Moneyland and the offshore system gave you this: you steal it, you hide it, and spend it. Everything is dynamic. And that is what allowed corruption to be unleashed. But we still think of corruption in national terms. You know, if you look at the Transparency International Corruption Perceptions Index, countries are ranked by country. You know, I think New Zealand at the top and South Sudan, whoever it is, at the bottom at the moment. But actually, kleptocracy, which is what the problem is now, is transnational by its nature. It always involves three jurisdictions as a minimum. And so it doesn't really make any sense to talk about London being clean or Britain being clean and Nigeria being dirty, because it's all part of the same system. And it's particularly vexing when you see someone like New Zealand being sort of top of the list, because New Zealand is, you know, the shell companies in New Zealand are about as bad as it gets, to be honest. They're almost as bad as what's happening in somewhere like Nevis. And yet, you know, because New Zealand is somewhere where you don't pay a bribe, you know, to a New Zealand official, it's not listed as corrupt. And actually, I think there's an element of colonial thinking still left in the way that we think of corruption. We think of it as something that happens over there. It's not a problem that affects us. But actually, it's because of these, got these three phases: stealing it, hiding it, and spending it. We're only talking about the stealing of it part. But actually, the second two parts are equally important. If you couldn't hide it, you wouldn't steal it. And if you couldn't spend it, you wouldn't steal it. So we need to start thinking about this as a transnational network and not just as a nationally bounded problem.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. And it's interesting, if we look at the idea of contagion, yeah, and that goes in many directions. You know, I'm thinking about how you look at the United States today and the associates of Donald Trump who have their very strong links with Ukraine and with Russia, with possible interference in the electoral process there. Brexit, with unknown donations, went into the referendum, which eventually resulted in a vote to leave. The tentacles of this type of thinking about I can buy whatever I want because they can, where that's leading to. It's a very dangerous place.
I mean, it's, you know, obviously if you look at this World Bank's type estimates, they say about $1 trillion is stolen every year from developing countries and stashed offshore and ultimately spent in wealthy countries. You know, $1 trillion is a huge amount of money. You know, if you had $1 trillion, it would take you 34,000 years to count them. It's a really ridiculous amount of money. And all of that money is owned by thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of different people from all over the world, all with different interests and different purchasing habits and all that, but they all have one overriding interest which they share, which is they don't want to have their money exposed, because if it's exposed it will be taken away from them. This is illegally acquired money. So any sort of political movement that would threaten to take that money away from them is inevitably going to be opposed by them. So you end up with this sort of wars of money that act against attempts to act transnationally against this transnational corruption. And I think this is certainly the way to see, say, Russia's determined opposition to the EU, for example. The EU has transnationally successfully created these, you know, anti-money laundering directives, which have been good and have brought up the standards in the EU countries from very, very poor to, okay, they're not great everywhere, but they're a lot better than they used to be. And we're acting together against this sort of transnational money. And it seems to me, certainly, that this kind of donations that went into funding the Brexit campaign from these unknown donors and still unknown donors, that's the best way to interpret them. These are people who really don't want the EU to succeed, because the EU is an organisation that was threatening to make it very difficult to stash stolen money here. I think also you probably can look at the interference in the American election in the same way. Anything that derails international or concerted action against dark money is a threat to the owners of dark money, and they will act together, even if they don't know each other, they will act together because they have a common interest in preventing this from happening, which is essentially another way of saying that dark money is the enemy of democracy, that there is a battle between money and democracy, and right now money is winning. And it's a very worrying thought that we aren't more aware of this as a society, and we really need to think about it, because, you know, $1 trillion a year is a lot of money, and that is being stolen every year, which means all of that money is stacked up against us, and the longer we don't act, the more money there will be essentially fighting back, and it's been fighting back very successfully.
And you make the point as well that Manafort, was the Trump associate, was using such similar processes as the Ukrainian politicians who stole all the money that they did. You know, exactly the same kind of pattern, same trajectory. It's interesting.
I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, actually, an article which I did since the book came out about the misuse of limited liability partnerships in the UK, which are owned offshore, I think, into Nevis and in other places, but are used as sort of secrecy vehicles. Manafort was using them in exactly the same way as Russian money laundering rings were using them, and Ukrainian oligarchs were using them, all for the same purposes, because they were disguising their identities and allowing them to move money around without being uncovered. But Manafort's not Ukrainian. He had the opportunity, and he took the opportunity, and that's what it is. Corruption is a crime of opportunity, and that's the thing. It's the thing about corruption. If you can steal stuff, you do. But it's not just a question of stealing stuff because you can. There's also an element of the system becoming compulsive. I had a friend in Ukraine who's a lawyer who was explaining it to me when I just started researching this. And he explained it to me by saying, look, you really got to understand it's not a matter of a choice between taking a bribe and not taking a bribe. The choice is between taking a bribe and having your children killed. Of course you take the bribe. You know, that really puts things into perspective, because if you're an honest person and you're going to sit there being honest and doing your job well and honestly, you are a threat to the whole system and you need to be got rid of. So it becomes a self-perpetuating system. It becomes, the corruption becomes the whole system. In fact, I quote in the book an SBU, which is the Ukrainian version of the KGB, the successor to the KGB. He actually says, look, if you think of Ukraine as corrupt, you're misunderstanding Ukraine, because corruption is a problem when it's a disease that afflicts a healthy system. It's maybe 10% of it, 15% is corrupt, like a mafia clan in New York. It's corruption is the bit that's diseased on a healthy system. In Ukraine, everything is corrupt. So it's not, you can't think of it as corrupt anymore, because you're thinking about it in the wrong way. The mafia and the state have become fused. We don't have words really to describe that. In the West, we don't have the concepts, and we really need to develop them.
That's true, but it's coming our way. It's coming our way. I was wanting to ask you quite an interesting example of how the rich can just stop the truth coming out. You know, just thinking, you were writing about the story that you couldn't publish. You spent all this time on a very good story, which you in the end couldn't publish. I think it's a good example of what sort of thing we're dealing with.
I have to be careful talking about this story because I wrote the chapter very carefully, and I went through and rewrote it to remove any identifying characteristics to make it impossible for anyone to tell who it is I'm writing about. I didn't identify the country they came from, any aspect of them. But essentially, I discovered a very wealthy, well-connected gentleman from a former Soviet country who had made an absolute killing it was illegal, but I mean, obviously, them not having ever been convicted of a crime. But what was amazing is they had sort of offshored their children to Europe. And these children were living here in this sort of Eurotrashy kind of a way, and were, you know, trying to have these kind of cultured, sort of sophisticated lifestyles, and essentially hired a load of really quite, I mean, famous, like household name, you know, cultural figures to essentially kind of hang out with them and be their kind of friends. And for me, it was like the perfect story because it was steal it, hide it, spend it all in one story, because I could see where the money came from. I could see, because of a couple of leaks and a bit of research I did in various places, how it was being hidden. I got all the shell companies, got all the documentation, everything I had. And then I could see where it was being spent because, you know, these people live on Instagram. You could just see it all happening. And it was absolutely all there. And then I wrote this article, which I was very proud of, actually. It was a lot. It was like years of work. And the lawyers said, I'm sorry, we can't do this. You know, this is British libel law, the insanity of British libel law, that it would be deemed defamatory to be connected to your own father when you're spending your father's money. It's like, it wasn't me that made the connection. The connection was made by them when they were spending his money. But that was the thing. And it makes it very, very hard to publish anything. I mean, and this isn't just something that's afflicted me. It's a sort of very disturbing story with Cambridge University Press when they had Karen DeWeese's book, Putin's Kleptocracy. I mean, I think they'd published, what, 5, 6 of her books before. She was an established on their roster, one of their authors. And they said, I'm sorry, we really like the book. It's very good. We have no complaints with its content or the way you've written it, but we cannot take the risk of publishing this book. The risk of being sued is more than we can take.
Right, and just to explain, in that book, she'd been writing about all her research into Putin and his links to organised crime.
Yeah, I mean, the darkest kinds of organised crime, you know, cocaine smuggling out in St. Petersburg, like the mob in Spain, like really thorough, detailed, incredibly well-researched book. Yeah, which was then published subsequently in the United States, where the law's a bit different. But this chilling effect of the British libel law stretches way beyond Britain. I have a friend in Angola called Raphael, who is Angola's sort of independent media scene. He's incredibly brave, you know, and a brilliant journalist. And he got sort of a letter from a UK libel specialist basically saying, you know, stop this or we'll come after you. And he says, well, go for it. I don't have anything for you to take. I work in my kitchen. Good luck. And so they wrote to all the publications that published him, which weren't in the UK. These are English language publications in various African countries. And they all dropped him because they couldn't take the risk. And that's it. That is now, how do you get information out of Angola now? You know, and this is, you know, wealthy Angolans, the daughter of the former president owns a big property empire in West London. This is like, these people are here and yet you can't read about them. Because of British libel law. And this is another part of it. That's another aspect of Moneyland. There's a loophole there. British libel law is very generous to the wealthy complainant. So you take advantage of the loophole and you shut down debate, and therefore you get to close channels of information. And that's not just a question of the reading public not being able to read what that's about, but journalist articles become, you know, they start legal investigations. They become, this is where police get their ideas from. You know, this is where due diligence companies get their information from when they're approving who's going to get a passport or not. It's really important raw material for the way the rest of the system works. And if you can shut that down, then wealthy people get away without being investigated in ways that they should.
And this is the whole thing about contagion, right? I mean, the race between nations on crappy legislation and secrecy, and the fact that the United States, the United Kingdom and some others are unashamedly trying to outdo each other to conquer the dirty money market. The UK has always been of concern, but Tax Justice Network's latest financial secrecy index names the United States the jurisdiction of most concern for them.
One of the most disquieting things I wrote about in the book, and if you look at the increase in assets held in trust in South Dakota since 2008-09, that sort of post-financial crash period, South Dakota, which releases these figures, the other big trust states in the US don't, in trust in South Dakota has risen from $40 billion to $250 billion in, what's that, 9 years. You know, that is a growth rate that, I mean, anyone would give their right hand for. And that's just one state with one trust system. But on top of that, you've got Wyoming, Nevada is massive, Delaware obviously is massive. You know, all of these places are just sucking this money in because, as actually a Nevadan state congressman explained to me, he said, who would put their money in Cyprus now where it's at risk from the US, you know, Department of Justice? You're not at risk here. I mean, the United States is very good in some ways, given their due. I mean, you know, the FBI is very good at investigating this. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is very important as a lever for doing this. But internally, domestically, there's just, this isn't happening. They're very good at projecting power beyond and projecting anti-corruption message overseas. But within America, they're really bad at it.
Inequality is booming in the most remarkable way. I mean, every year, I mean, I think, was it 2 years ago, 62 people had the same amount of wealth as the bottom half of the world's population.
This year it was 42 people. I suppose next year it will be even fewer. And this is totally skewing how democracy works and how politics works.
I've been talking to journalist Oliver Bullough about his new book, Moneyland, out this month and published by Profile Books. It's a real page-turner. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.